Danny is going to talk for half an hour, and he's going to take a question at a time and try and give you as thorough a response as possible. So rather than bombarding with five or six questions, it's all about the quality, not about the quantity. So I'll hand over to Professor Dorling.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I will just talk for half an hour or less, because I am most interested in what you have to say and what you, how you react to what I have to tell you. I've been looking at inequalities in health in Britain with many colleagues for about 20 years. 20 years ago, in 1996, when I was living in Bristol, we began work on a book which ended up being called The Widening Gap, about the growing divide between the health of people who were poor and people who were rich. And we looked at official government data which showed that gap had been widening since the late 1970s, and we said the gap was terrible. And we also looked at the geographical gap, the difference in life expectancy between the poorest areas and the richest areas of the country, and we found that that had also been widening, again from the late 1970s onwards. And we wrote a chapter at the end of that book, The Widening Gap, which my colleague said somewhat read as, "What have the Romans ever done for us?" Because it was a criticism of the new Labour government, which had just come into power, about what it might achieve. And if you can remember back 20 years ago, there was a great hope that inequalities would be reduced because of that government. Now, the government did reduce two inequalities. It reduced the inequality in infant mortality in the country, but nobody noticed, because by the time it reduced it, it was out of office. And it also reduced the geographical inequalities ever so slightly, because it pumped money into what it called spearhead areas and it gave people statins. And it kind of held inequality at a high and mildly rising state, while giving healthy start food to kids and increasing the amount of money spent on social care so people got visits, and putting some money into the health service, which had been starved for years, so that it got a little bit better. But we had an incredibly underfunded health service by then. And then we got the coalition government in 2010. And what I really want to tell you is what the coalition government have done, what their record on health is, and then try to work out why it has been quite as bad as I'm about to describe to you. Do you remember when David Cameron introduced his happiness measure? We were going to measure the nation's happiness every year and report on it. And a very complicated measure of happiness was created that included all kinds of things. But in terms of health, it included the answers that the population give to a question which is asked every year about their own health, in what's called, what used to be called, the British Household Panel Study, which is now Living in Britain. And the first measure was 2010. And then when it was asked again in 2011, it got worse. Then it got worse again. People said their health was worse again in 2012. 2013 was worse again. And then in March this year, March 2016, the Office of National Statistics released the latest national figure about people's health when they're asked about their health as part of Cameron's Happiness Index. And people's reporting of their state of the health didn't just fall, it had fallen so far, and the latest data is for 2014 for this, that it fell outside the confidence limits given the year before for how big it could be expected to be by chance. And nobody reported this, because all the authorities were charged with doing was collecting and publishing the data, not reacting to what the data showed. We produced a happiness index for Britain, but nobody had any responsibility to check if we were getting less happy. But that's self-rated health. And you might say, well, you know, people were feeling a bit more miserable. We'd had an almighty economic crash in 2009, 2010. You know, of course people are going to get a bit more moany, but in practice, you know, as long as they have a stiff upper lip and work hard, it'll all be okay. And if they're bad and they get fat or smoke too much, it's their own fault. That was a kind of prevailing wisdom. Then something else began to happen. People began to die. Now this only became clear around about 2012, early 2013. Tiny top story, I think, in the Daily Telegraph. Which I do read the Daily Telegraph because you can read it for free online. And if anything gets in the Daily Telegraph and is about things getting worse, it does tend to be true. It's a measure you can use. Elderly women's life expectancy had fallen by 5 weeks. Might not sound very much to you, but smoking a cigarette takes 11 minutes off your life. So you can do the maths and work out how many cigarettes every elderly woman would have had to smoke to have the same effect as losing 5 weeks of life. It's many thousand. 5 weeks of life expectancy drop is unusual. And this fall in the life expectancy of elderly women, women around about 85, was accompanied by a dramatic fall in the visits from social workers to the elderly. The numbers had almost halved from 2010 onwards because of the cuts. Falls in Meals on Wheels visits. These visits are not, well, Meals on Wheels are good because it gets you food. People have assessed these visits. You know, when somebody turns up for 15 minutes, takes their coat off, puts the kettle on, makes a cup of tea, says, "How are you, dear?" puts the coat back on, goes out, gets in the car, drives to the next person. The visits have generally been assessed as being pretty useless, except if somebody is near death or has fallen down the stairs and is at the bottom of the stairs. Then they are very, very useful to do. We should, of course, have a system where people are seen more than 15 minutes a week by somebody. But what we've actually had is a cut. So I wrote an article in the New Statesman magazine asking why the old were beginning to die more and linking it to the cuts and austerity. The response of the authorities was to put four press officers onto me and ask me to take the article down because it wasn't factually correct, and how could I do this? Luckily, because I'm a boring academic, I had a version of the article with something like 24 references in it. Now, New Statesman don't publish references, but I put the version up with that and I asked the press officers which of these facts is incorrect, and they went quiet, but they weren't happy with me. And then a year later, they asked if I'd be on the National Mortality Surveillance Committee for government. Partly because they would rather have you inside pissing out rather than outside pissing in. Partly because they were beginning to get worried. And they were beginning to get worried because the deaths carried on rising. Then there was a little lull in 2014. 2014 wasn't a good year, it's actually a very bad year. If we took the improvement in health we had had since 1997 to 2010 and projected it forward, we would have many, many tens of thousands of people still alive now. What's actually happened is things stopped getting better after 2010. Health improves. In the entire planet, for the last 40 years, life expectancy has tended to have risen by a third of a year a year. This is the norm. Health improves. The infant mortality rate has fallen and continues to fall incredibly. Life expectancy goes up. This is what we are used to. There's a big lag effect. There's a lag effect of better nutrition. It's why your children are mostly taller than you and why their children should be taller than you and than them. Right. Health generally gets better. It doesn't stay the same. And it's been getting better in other countries in Europe. We have one of the lowest life expectancies in Europe. Now, the point I'm getting to, and I'm sorry for the long-winded wind-up to this, is what happened in 2015. we're now beginning to know more and more about what happened in 2015. In the first few weeks of 2015, thousands and thousands and thousands of elderly people died who would not normally die. And that carried on in the second, the third, the fourth week, and into the February, and into the March, and into the April. So that when we got to the end of 2015, we thought about 20,000 more people dying than had died a year before. That's an incredibly large number. There were a few newspaper reports in February on it. Not very much. And the government, or their officials, blamed it on the flu. So we'd had some flu. And we had a vaccine that wasn't very good, and because of that, this had happened. Now the problem with that is, flu epidemics tend to kill people in about 5 weeks. It's a short period, not week after week after week. Flu tends to kill younger people. All the previous flu epidemics we've had before the bit of flu we had in 2015 has mostly affected people under 65. And flu also tends to show up in laboratory tests when you actually test to see if it was flu. When the death certificates came in 2015, it turns out that the most common cause of death of these people, elderly people mainly, who had died, was listed as Alzheimer's or dementia. Now, you do not suddenly get an outbreak of Alzheimer's or dementia. It's not something which suddenly increases in number because of something in the water. What had happened was that people who were frail and old and desperate and couldn't shout out for themselves were not being cared for and were dying in higher numbers, of which a small proportion were dying of flu, but most were not dying of flu. And in the very worst weeks of this, we had record peaks of 4-hour trolley waits in our hospitals. We had record numbers of nursing vacancies. We had a systematic crisis in the health service in January 2015. And we have no mechanism for monitoring this. There is no mechanism to say things have got so bad that our health system is no longer coping with the people who are turning up in ambulances to it, often dehydrated from care homes. No worries. And in the care homes, this is good because you help cheer it up slightly. Because my problem of doing this talk is, I'll try towards the end of making this cheering. I've only got 15 minutes to go. We had a systematic crisis of an underfunded health service that couldn't cope. Not a particularly cold winter, just a badly funded health service. But behind that, we had a care system, a social care system, which was failing. Which is why people ended up getting iller faster and presenting themselves. And we thought that was bad. But other events were happening. There was a referendum on something going on. And so this kind of dropped out of the news. Now, ironically, the Office of National Statistics had scheduled, there's no conspiracy on this, a lot of this really is cock-up. And the more I get to know about it, the more I don't believe in a conspiracy, the more I believe in ignorance and stupidity. But we can do that in questions. The date that the national figures were set to be released, that would let us find out what had really happened, was the 23rd of June. At 10 o'clock on the 23rd of June, the figures were released. We needed the national figures, first of all, to check the weekly numbers that had been released. Luckily, they weren't cut. ONS have had a huge number of cuts to the statistics, and one of the proposals was to actually cut the release of the weekly death figures. But luckily, they weren't. The other reason we needed the figures that were released on the 23rd of June is that they include the population numbers. Because if we had had a sudden massive influx of elderly people into this country, supposing loads of elderly people had decided to come back from Spain, thinking that we might vote to leave and they might be in trouble, you never know, it could have happened, it didn't. But we needed those figures on the 23rd of June to be able to tell whether this rise in deaths was a real rise in death rates. And we got them. And almost nobody looked. And for the first time in years, there was no press release. There was no press release because of the Perda embargo on the Office of National Statistics releasing any news that might influence a vote. Right? So, what did the figures say? The figures said that in fact we'd had 40,000 more people die in England and Wales, not 20,000. The figures said that the rise in mortality across the board for all ages in 1 year, this is a rise over an average year 2014 to a very high year, was 9%. 9% increase in deaths. 15% for the 90-year-olds, about 12% for the 85-year-olds, 9% for the 80-year-olds, 7% for the 75-year-olds. Not so bad for the kind of 67-year-olds, because you kind of get out of benefit sanctions at that point. You're into your pension and things are good. The only adult age group for which health improved were 25 to 29-year-olds. And that was the age group where they'd had immigration. 66,000 net immigrants. Healthy immigrants. The immigrants are healthy. They don't die. Without the immigrants, we would have had falling life expectancy for several years now. And that's not even the help in the social care sector, in the care homes, in the hospitals for immigrants. That's simply immigrants turning up with their healthy young bodies, not dying and adding to the denominator population. Now, I've just said 9% and you haven't reacted in shock and awe, and I've said 40,000 and you haven't reacted in shock and awe, because you have no reason to know whether 40,000 is high or low, or 9% is high or low. And I am too careful and sensitive to get you to work out how many is 40,000 deaths compared to the last time news of a lot of elderly women dying unexpectedly occurred. I'm not going to say it. I've been very tempted to say this. Part of the reason this news story hasn't been picked up is because it was elderly people, particularly elderly women, the group who are least cared about, who were going to die anyway in 3 or 5 or 7 or 9 years. So how big is a 9% rise? The last time we had a 9% rise in mortality in this country in 1 year was 1940. This hasn't occurred in my lifetime, and this hasn't occurred in my parents' lifetime, because they were born in 1942. This is the biggest increase in 1 year in deaths we have had for two generations. The last equivalent figure was that high because of bombing by the Luftwaffe and because of injured troops dying who'd been brought back and because of diseases spreading in wartime. 1940. The nearest one, which is close, which is not as big as the rise in deaths in 2015, was the 1951 genuine flu epidemic, when it really was flu. And in 1951 in Liverpool, more people died of flu than in the pandemic of 1918, the world's biggest pandemic for two centuries. But the number of deaths was bigger last year, but just of elderly people. You can go back further. I will not try to bore you about it, but I'm just trying to go there. This is the biggest failure of government in not just my lifetime, but my parents' lifetime. This is bigger than Suez and other things. The other equivalent dates in British history, where we've had a rise of more than 9%, is the cholera outbreak of 1846, cholera in 1849, the Great Frost of 1895, it was very, very cold, the pandemic of 1918, the freezing winter of 1929. Nothing else since 1940. Cameron's going to be the first Prime Minister to leave office with falling life expectancy. It is hard to think of a worse record than that. So, I've got 10 minutes left. What's this got to do with inequality? Isn't it just the immigrants? Because they cause all the problems in Britain. It must have been them. You know, they must have been sneaking out there at night and... Okay. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to find out what happens now, isn't it? The superficial reason for these deaths being brought forward was a health service in crisis that could not cope. Then the reason, which is almost as superficial just behind that, is a social care system which was being cut. But behind that, there are the cuts in pension credits, which people, my colleague Rachel Loopstra, has demonstrated a correlation with the fall in elderly health, and the fall in pension credits is just remarkably close. And then, of course, there are the deaths associated with the actions of DWP, which are massively significant, but out of 40,000 begin to look small. They're not small. It's just we've had the biggest event since 1940. Then there's the increase in drugs overdoses, a huge increase we've had in drugs overdoses of people about my age, people who first tried drugs when they were 20 years younger than me, got off them, now trying again. There's lots and lots of different superficial causes. But beneath all of this is a society that has become ever more fractured since the 1970s. So fractured that not only does this happen, not only do we see life expectancy falling, which is already low, but it isn't even an issue. Because there is no such thing as society. There is only you and your family. And if you look after yourself, you'll be okay. So you can't have a systematic effect that matters by that way of thinking. You don't need to monitor the figures. If 40,000 people die age 85 and 90, they just weren't trying hard enough. It's the rhetoric. And I think that's the biggest message that's come out of this. Not just that we have created a society in which this can occur, and as far as I can see, this has occurred nowhere else in Europe. So you can have a completely collapsing economy in Greece, and they had poor health, but they didn't have this, because Greek society was more of a solidarity society. We have become a much less solidarity society. The irony of it, we've begun to look at where the rises of deaths have been. Oh, by the way, the rises are twice as big in Scotland as in England and Wales. And I haven't even included Scotland in trying to work out this is the biggest since when. It's not in the poorest areas. Partly because there aren't that many people who are that elderly and frail left in the poorest areas. In poor working class areas, people tend to die before they're 80. It's actually along the coasts and in more isolated rural areas. It's places where you might buy that bungalow to retire in that's a bit isolated, but it's very pretty. Which is very nice, but you'd be much better off in a terrace in Bolton when the Meals and Wheels stops and the rural bus service goes, because there's a shop down the road. It's spread right across England and Wales. There's an irony that the age group it has occurred to, mainly elderly people, are an age group who are mainly middle class, because elderly people are middle class people are the people who get to be this age. And if you think back to where they were in 1979 and 83 and 87, the majority of these people will have voted for the Conservative governments that actually destroyed the systems of social care and protection that meant that when they were in need, there wasn't anything for them. There was a pledge during the referendum to spend £350 million more on the National Health Service. I quite like the idea of holding people to that pledge. It's not enough. If we wanted to spend on our health the same amount that Germany spends on its health, we would have to spend £1,050,000,000 a week to get ourselves on a par with German health spending. We'd have to spend 27% more to be the same as the French. We'd have to double our health spending if we wanted to spend the same amount they spend in Switzerland on their health. And in Switzerland, interestingly, you go to Swiss meetings and the debate's all about, are we spending a bit too much? Because they are spending the most in Europe. But to be honest, what matters more than health? But we, apart from Greece since the crash and Italy since the crash, we have the lowest spending per head of anywhere in Western Europe. Luckily, we have the most efficient health service in Europe. It's incredibly efficient, more efficient than other systems in the rest of Europe, because it still has a legacy of solidarity and a way of behaving and of not being fractured. And if it wasn't for that, things would be far worse. But it's rising inequality that got us in this position. It's rising inequality that got us to a point where we don't even recognise With colleagues, we've been trying very hard to get this story into newspapers in the last few weeks. We really have emailed a lot of journalists, and they just don't get it, mainly because it's numerical, mainly because I won't describe how many mass murderers this would be the equivalent to, because I don't want to drag it down to that. But sometimes when you're beginning to lose your temper, you think you're going to have to do it that way. This will come out, because around about September the official life expectancy figures will be produced, and they will show this fall, and people will notice. And then it'll accelerate, because young, fit people educated elsewhere will stop coming to this country. That's the biggest change that's about to happen. Somebody sitting in France or Italy thinking of working in a cafe here for fun might just go somewhere else. And when those people don't turn up, and when the 200 anaesthetists who are citizens of another European country think, maybe I'll be an anaesthetist somewhere that actually wants me, and when the other healthcare workers don't turn up, and when the people who are here but don't have a right to be here don't believe our promise that we'll look after them, because they won't have the same rights as everybody else, no matter what we say, then we're going to begin to see this get worse. And that's saying a lot, because this is a dramatic event which has just happened. And you can worry a little bit more about it. What happens when some of our over a million pensioners who are just about eking it out in Malaga decide to return and exercise their right to a free health service at the point of delivery here? How are we going to cope with them? When we reduced the winter fuel payments to overseas pensioners, do you remember when we did that? Save a bit of money, it was sunny. It was a stupid thing to do, because it meant on the margins a few of them came back home, because they were just about managing to live out there because of those payments. And suddenly we had to pick up the whole bill of looking after them, rather than putting the bill on Crete or on Cyprus or on Spain or on Portugal, where they currently are. What to do about it, because I've got 1 minute left. Very good.
We've got a bit of time.
We have got time, and we've got lots of time for questions.
Yeah.
The good news about this is that it isn't a virus. It's not the flu. It's not some kind of secret virus. They've actually been checking for that, because public health officials love viruses. They love telling people to be fit and eat well. They don't like social explanations of things. The good news is that all people actually need is somebody to see them once a week and say, how are you doing? The good news is that you can have a huge effect through hope. The suicide in this country amongst the elderly halved after 1945, because they knew that insurance and pensions were coming, and they knew they were going to get a health service. So you were no longer a burden on your children, and you didn't kill yourself. This was before 1948. You can have huge psychosocial effects on the population. The suicide rate fell after 97, because things could only get better. And people believe that, which is, gets you halfway there, it's just you've got to keep it up. What is needed is not that hard to provide. It is greater social solidarity. It is actually, ironically, the big society is going to have to happen. We do need to increase funding for our health service. That is remarkably easy, even in straitened times, because you simply stop spending money on stupid things, such as nuclear weapons that you never intend to use unless you're mad. The question is, when are we going to begin to demand this? When are we, just looking at the age, you know, in this room, 10% of you are under 30. I see a few people in their 30s, but more people in their 40s are my age, and then perhaps even slightly more in their 50s, and the odd couple I would stereotype in their 60s, and none of you look like you in your 70s. But selfishly,
who are you looking at?
Selfishly, even if you don't care about anybody else in the world, but you think you're going to carry on living in this country, what do you want to happen to you in your last 5 years? What kind of society do you need for you, just for what happens to you? And if we can get through the message of what has just happened, I think it is not impossible to get people to realise that the biggest rise in deaths since the year 1940 is something to remember David Cameron and his government by, and the coalition by. It crystallises the effect of what they did. It wasn't the crash. It was years after the crash. We can begin to see the mechanisms of what's happened. We know who to blame and what to blame them for. And we know what we need to begin to do to get out of it. We also are going to need an enormous amount of solidarity in progressive politics, because you cannot have a divide between the Liberals, Labour, the Greens, Plaid Cymru and whatever else in a first-past-the-post system when you're fighting UKIP and the Tories. But the stakes haven't been as high in terms of premature mortality since 1940. Thank you very much.
We've got 50 minutes, so we've got plenty of time for questions. And as I say, we're going to take a question at a time so that Danny can answer the questions in full. But I think there's plenty of time for everyone to ask what they would like.
Yes, I'm Becky. I'm in Workers' Liberty. This event is called Changing Labour, Changing Politics, yes. And a lot of us here are active in the Labour Party and the movement that's been around Jeremy Corbyn's election. And this, to me, sounds like the kind of issue that the Labour Party should be standing, you know, this, if we don't campaign on anything else, this kind of thing is what we should be fighting the next election about and using all the time up to it to highlight. So what do you think the potential role of the Labour Party would be in this time? Would you be willing to work with activists in the Labour Party to foreground this issue?
I've worked with both sides of the Labour Party recently. I went and did something for the PLP at Tristram Hunt's invitation on these kind of issues, and I'm very friendly with the other side of the Labour Party. At the moment, the Labour Party has its mind elsewhere. It's had a series of Shadow Secretary of States for Health. It's got a nice new one now. I'll answer your question in a second. I don't worry about the splits within the Labour Party as much as I worry about the splits between Labour and the Greens, which really matter in an election, and Labour and Plaid, and even Labour and the Liberals in some areas. I think there's actually a useful potential outcome from the split within Labour, and its lack of concentration, ability to concentrate on issues, because we have a completely split progressive politics in Britain. And we're going to have a one-off election where people don't stand against each other, where PR's on the agenda, and you can get a decent politics in this country and then do what you like, which is fair. Labour have got plenty of time to begin to run with this. You know, to be fair to them, this is relatively recent news. I didn't calculate that 1940 figure until not last night, the night before, when the Guardian told me they weren't running the story because it wasn't new, because they'd reported that deaths had risen in February, because that was 20,000. And so it's only another 20,000. What does it matter? Seriously, the Guardian subeditor had dropped the story. So I thought, I'll check just how big it is. So this is new. This will eke out with numerous official statistics over the next few months. And there's plenty of time for Labour to use this and explain to people what it means. I get very worried that people might not care. Some people might not care. Can you remember, I've forgotten which Chancellor said that unemployment was a price worth paying for economic strength?
Norman Lamont,
was it?
Yeah.
Don't know. I get. They all blur into one kind of fairly antisocial figure in my head. It's only a matter of time before somebody of that kind of character says, actually, in straitened times, the premature deaths of the elderly have saved us a lot of money. That is the kind of society we have created. And so when you begin to talk about this in a society that's become more individualistic, I think part of what you have to do is to get people to think, you know, your kids are not going to look after you on your deathbed, or even the 5 years away from that. They may not even be in this country. It'll be somebody else. It'll be somebody from Portugal. Do you want them worrying about the job they're going to be doing at night, driving a taxi so that they can pay the bedroom tax, so they're tired out when they're putting a catheter in your arm? Or would you rather live in a society where your last 5 years are decent? And I think Labour needs to talk about that selfish reason to want to behave in a solidarity society, as well as the reasons that anybody with any emotions or pro-social sense should have an idea for. There's a last at the back.
I was just going to check some figures for you because I didn't get to write them down, but I'll do it at the end.
If you want the figures, they are in the British Medical Journal this Friday, which is online. I did manage to get the British Medical Journal to publish the figures. A nice thing's happened in medicine. Suddenly doctors have become more radical than they've ever been. And the British Medical Association, which owns the British Medical Journal, is moving. There are lots of good things going on at the moment.
We've got another comrade at the back there.
I mean, of course, now I can't remember where I got the figures from, but I remember reading somewhere saying that the longer you work, the sooner you die. Mm. And so it seems to me that there's such a cynical move to extend the pension age,
yeah,
you know, to 67, because they must know at some level,
yeah,
that your death rate is going to be sooner.
Can increase. It's having to work when you don't want to work.
Yeah.
Working when you have chosen to work is brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are numerous, but full employment allows people to choose to work because they can choose the job they do, walk out of one, walk into another. A living wage, the reason for a living wage is to give people the genuine choice of whether to work or not. And if you choose to live on, so not living wage, the citizens' income. If you choose not to work, you just have a life on a quite low level of consumption, but still a decent life. We know that pensioners who are people of pension age who are forced to work have a higher suicide rate than pensioners who can choose not to work. We know in Japan, which has the highest life expectancy in the world and is one of the most equal of the rich countries in the world, women actually live 8 years longer than men, not just five in this country, partly because men don't have a choice about working. It's a very sexist society, but that sexism has lots of bad effects on women, but it has a very bad effect on men's health. Work needs to be a choice. The important thing about that is there is absolutely no need for everybody to work, because there is not enough that needs to be done. 10% of people are working in shops, coming up to you and saying, can I help you with that, to try to encourage you to buy something you didn't need. We have a huge number of people doing work which is antisocial and counterproductive. We could have far fewer people working and have a far better society. This all began with when most of us worked on the fields. It was the main occupation over 100 years ago with no tractors. The majority job of women just under 100 years ago is working in service as a servant. You can all make your own bed and clean your own house. There's all kinds of jobs that can go we don't need. But the other side of it is, if you want to work, it is very bad for your health if there isn't work available. So the unemployed in the 1980s died at twice the rate of the unemployed. It's partly stigma, partly poverty, but partly just being imprisoned by not being able to contribute. So you need freedom both ways.
Mm-hmm. We've got three comrades who want to ask questions.
I'm Cara, thank you for the talk. I found it really sad, but not because it wasn't brilliant, because it was. But my uncle actually passed away from Alzheimer's New Year's Eve 2014, so he would have missed out on being one of the 40,000, but part of the same issue. But my question is slightly separate from that, in that we've seen over the election of Jeremy Corbyn, etc., the role that social media has played. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on the role of social media in getting statistics like this out that the mainstream media as you've experienced with this refuse to print, is there a role for it to play, or is it only going to ever provide a discussion base for things that have already been published?
The problem is we all live in different social media worlds, okay? I mean, my social media world is remarkably left-wing, just given who wants to friend me, you know, which is, it's great, but it's not representative of Britain. And the problem is, all I know about social media is that one I see. And in that one I see, if something gets published somewhere, it can be spread very quickly, but it needs to be published. A London School of Economics blog will do, almost anywhere will do. I don't think... Is the Morning Star free online? This is the problem with... It is?
Yeah.
Okay, as long as it gets in the Morning Star and you have free access online, you can spread a story, but it must... Something must be published. What publishing means is that it's gone for at least one edit, and that's the difference between a comment at the bottom of something and something slightly more thought about, because whenever you produce these things, you get people sending you stuff saying, that's complete rubbish. And you need some form of checking. Social media, as far as I can see, can spread things, but the thing has to exist somewhere else. But there are lots and lots of blogs, not just newspapers. The other thing is to ask questions. You know, so just say, when was the last time we had a rise in deaths as big as this? Because the authorities don't actually know.
PCS, I don't want to drown it. I'm not sure I quite am persuaded by the statement that what's really needed is somehow for the Labour, the Liberals, Greens, whatever, to get together.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because it's not as simple as talking, it seems to me at least, as talking about Liberals, Labour, and Greens in that way without political differentiation. Madison, I remember you were talking about famous people in their quotes, said he was. Very relaxed about people getting filthy rich. He now says, "Oh, I wouldn't say that today because of the rise in inequality, but rise in inequality is clearly a consequence of some people getting filthy rich." Bloody obvious. But he also said he was relaxed because they paid their taxes, when you feel that Liberals are not paying their taxes. Look at some of the Liberals, and you'll know this better than I am, sure. The Orange Book Liberals were in favour of privatising the NHS.
Mm.
So I think there's an issue about that, but that's not what I want to dwell on.
Yeah.
What I found very interesting was one of your last comments about if we work less, or we did this or that differently, we consume less, we'd be happier. That seems to me to point to a different organisation or society, whatever that might be. It may be vague, but it seems to point to that, which I think is a bit different to your other probably reasonable point. But it wouldn't take much in some ways to bring some of that increase in mortality down. One's about how you address a specific point at a given time. The other is how to create, it seems to me at least, what you're saying, is how to create a happier, more beneficial society going forward. In that context, two or three questions initially. One is, how do you see people like yourself working with the trade unions? In my trade union, which is supposedly led by far less socialists, I despair with others, myself and some comrades, put up motions relating to the work of Professor Wilkinson, Pickett, and Marmot and others, in respect of unions, got them adopted, saying the union should work with these intellectuals and academics, to launch a campaign for equality, and you can give very precise instructions, and then it dies. Their vision doesn't seem to go beyond very narrow trade unions, no matter how left-wing they see themselves as. So how can rank and file trade unions, who are interested in these issues, work with people like yourself?
Okay. Just one more, because I can't remember too many.
The first question was, how do you see the relationship between transforming society and the reforming place?
Yeah.
The second was, how can people like yourself work with trade unions who want to do something on this subject? The third is really about, how do you see your mortality issue in relation to general inequality? Because the most shocking thing I think you said was not the rising mortality rate, which is shocking. Actually, the most shocking thing you said was it's affecting the class people, because the working class people don't tend to live that long. Mm-hmm. Nothing, that's right. But in the civil service, where I work, they've had a 40 year study, one or two studies, which show that morbidity and mortality rates in sharp inverse ratio to the greater civil servant.
Yeah.
And yet we have industrial policies, bring it right down to the micro level, that will sack people if they have X amount of days off a year. But we know the only people who have X amount of days off a year are most junior, lowest paid people, who are then forced into poverty, forced onto low pensions, etc. So how do you see your point about the increase in mortality related to the general issues of inequality that have been very apparent for
the
work of
Townsend
in the
60s. Yeah, okay. Loads of questions. Let me just try and do it. On the very first point, which is mine, it's about short-term conveniences of what we do. John McDonnell has said he's willing to put PR in the Labour manifesto. You put PR in the Labour manifesto, other political parties will roll over and get out of your way and help. You've got to... You've got to work with them in a way you haven't worked before for one election. There's no need for any referendums. If something is in a manifesto, it's in a manifesto. Referendums is what they did in Germany in the 1930s. Referendums are dangerous. And that is very hard, but it's a one-off. When people ask me what to do, my suggestion is work in your own constituency with other people who are like-minded with you, and try to work out what to do in your own constituency so that when the choice comes, you don't get one of those two parties, which in some ways are the same party, UKIP and the Tories. It's the same people running them. As the referendum campaign showed, you know, the same group. On trade unions, occasionally a trade union appoints a very good researcher and they do a lot. It's very rare, very occasionally, and then they get stolen and taken away by Corbyn to be their chief little officer.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah. Rank and file members always had Ruskin College, which was interesting. I don't know if you know, it's a working class college in Oxford. Nothing to do with my university. But it's in trouble now. So the unions could try to work out what to do about the union's own little college and the Northern College near Sheffield, because those have been the body set up for years to make sure that trade union members could mix with academics. In the 1930s, Tawney, who wrote Equality, I think in the 30s, 40s and 50s he worked with trade unionists in Ruskin. So this was a tradition of doing this. The last one on the Whitehall studies. I mean, the Whitehall studies are remarkable. The Whitehall studies show that a top civil servant can drink whiskey and smoke and still expect to live longer than the boy in the post room on the lowest salary who didn't smoke and didn't drink would still actually have a shorter life, because a top civil servant has freedom and power and is in charge of their own day and also feels that they're doing something. It doesn't actually matter if you are doing something, as long as you think you're doing something, you'll be better off. Whereas if every day you have to sort the post into pigeonholes and you have to be there early in the morning to do it because they expect the post to be there, it will slowly damage your health because of a lack of freedom. There is an irony in the fact that it is disproportionate numbers of the elderly who voted for a more individualistic society who have died prematurely. I mean, this is supposition, it just makes sense. But I don't think we should... I think we should be magnanimous and just say this shows how bad it was. It was actually bad for themselves. The point at which I began to most dislike the Conservatives was when I was 21 years old. And I was in Oxford, and I was in the John Radcliffe Hospital. And in the John Radcliffe Hospital, there were only 8 intensive therapy unit beds because Maggie had cut the funding. Each bed requires 3 nurses. Each nurse works 8 shifts. ITU is where you go when they take you out of intensive care to see whether you're going to die or not. Most people die in ITU. All the beds were full. If Maggie had been in a car accident coming back from Chequers to Downing Street, which passes very near to Oxford, there wasn't an ITU bed for her, but it was seen as a price worth paying to underfund those beds and underfund accidents and emergency services in the 1980s, because we should reduce taxes and let the rich have as much as they need. And if some bugger gets in a situation where they need intensive care, well, economically it makes more sense just to let them die. And I saw that in the 1980s. That is the mentality. Holding that mentality is what drove people to join the Conservative Party. It's what drove those young men. I was a schoolboy in Oxford at the time when David was there and Boris was there and little George was there and little Michael was there. Right? Why did they fall in love with Margaret Thatcher at the same time as I began to hate her? They fell in love with her ideas that it is good to be ruthless, it is good to be soft, so it's not to be too soft, it is good not to plan. And if there are a few victims along the way, well, that's the price of making Britain great again. And I think we have to recognise this is the kind of battle we're in. The other thing is not to underestimate the power of inequality and of fear. Not to underestimate how much one group of people want to take control of a country, to get us to fear the immigrants who came in, to get a whole load of UKIP members of Parliament, to get an alliance between UKIP and the Conservatives and the majority, to privatise the National Health Service, to make it like the United States of America. Because they believe it is weak and inefficient in a Darwinian world to worry too much about 40,000 already elderly people dying early. There are more important things to be done, and if we make Britain great again, we make it the richest country in the world again, well, somehow that'll all trickle down and you'll all be okay. And that's the biggest fight we're in. And my worry, that's why I say we're going to have to do a bit of working together, because in some ways we're heading into the 1930s in terms of inequalities and fear. And now is the time when we could either go one of two ways. And it doesn't necessarily have to be bad. It could potentially be very, very good. Nobody has done as much. No Labour Prime Minister has done as much to reduce inequalities in wealth in a shorter time as Boris Johnson managed with that referendum. If you look at the investment portfolios of people in Notting Hill, the value of their stocks and shares, probably the equity in their houses, the fall that there's been since the 23rd in the wealth of the richest people in London. Just look at the Sunday Times wish list. Look at Grosvenor Square. It's an unbelievable reduction in wealth inequality that's occurred in 2 weeks. Now, it may not be sustained, but last time we had something like this was 1913. And there always is an end to a peak. Inequality has been rising since the 1970s, has hit its highest peak, not quite as high as 1913, but very high, and it has faltered. In other countries of the world, inequality is already falling, only just, so we're very cautious, but it is. My favourite example is the United States of America, where a trade union released information last year saying that the bosses of the Savings and Poor 500, the richest 500 bosses, had seen their average annual income fall by $1.1 million in a year. Massive fall. And the average income of workers in the US had risen by $900. Right? Doesn't sound like much, but a lot of average workers, only a few bosses. So the pay ratio between the bosses and the workers in the US has gone from about 373 to 1 to about 323 from 1. I'm not weird enough to be able to get them exactly right, but it's something like that. The best thing about this, and this is the opposite to our reporting of these deaths, has not been that important. The best thing about that was that when it was reported, the headline was, gap still too big. Not biggest ever fall for 40 years in US income inequality, gap still too big. if it has begun to fall in the US, if it could begin to fall here, it is falling in all... It is falling in almost half of OECD countries. It's falling in the majority of the rest of the world, but there are huge inequalities. It's only just... It is not impossible that we're on the edge of something much better, but it is not impossible that we're also on the edge of rising fascism in Europe.
We've got 25 minutes, we've got three speakers. I'll take those and we'll see if we've got time.
I'll be shorter, I promise. Yeah. if you do a short question, I'll do a short answer.
I think we're really lucky to have Darren here, because the statistics that you're coming out with, I've heard before in places, and in geography back in the 70s, so I've followed what's happening, but you don't really see it presented in so clearly about what's happening at the present moment, so that this isn't academic, this is critical, because it seems to be that we've swallowed the narrative over the last 10, 20, 30 years, that Britain's a rich country, it keeps being repeated, well, fourth or fifth or like sixth or seventh by half rolling, but we're very high up, we're a rich country, and things are generally improving, so stick with it, because this austerity is sort of working, and onwards and upwards, and they keep quoting statistics that sort of work. And we've sort of swallowed it a little bit, that's what's going on. And I think the left have particularly swallowed it over immigration. That immigration is really what the left is saying is defender of immigrants, fight racism, but really, yes, immigration is a problem for this country at the deepest end of it. It's the root of falling wages, it's the root of the island being overcrowded physically. You haven't got enough space, that's the thing you keep often hear repeated. We haven't got enough physical space, there's too much pressure on schools and hospitals and that, so you can't get that bed and that intensive care unit. And all the rest of it, and the left have followed that narrative, and they've just repeated it in a sort of way. Sometimes you hear it quite blatantly, and actually somebody like John Mann from Nottinghamshire will say, yes, we blame immigrants. He will come out with it very clearly.
Yeah.
Whereas someone like Dennis Skinner will say, I don't blame immigrants, but definitely EU is a problem. And underneath it, and then you hear the Socialist Party and the SWP, sometimes they won't say it very blatantly, but when pushed, they'll say, look, there is a problem. These things are driving down wages. Now, we often don't have any statistics that simply says it back, you know, where you can simply say, no, immigration does not depress wages, or immigration in this country is not overcrowded the island, or any of the or inequality is actually rising. All these sort of statistics are going on. But what I've noticed is that in the papers that keep repeating this narrative all over, say if you take The Sun, the Daily Express, The Mail, these sort of Daily Star, these sort of papers, they have a constant theme, which is that dementia, cancer and other things like that, there's always a cure for, whether it's great for you, it's a good for you, or what's bad for you. That's a constant theme of all these papers that are coming on, but they don't mention this thing about rising mortality. They don't really go on, they don't really pick up on that. They actually say there's different ways of avoiding the inevitable death that you're going to have. You can avoid dementia by doing this, or you can do that. But they don't actually come out with anything at all like that.
No.
So I think what you need to do is use the statistics. I'll give you one example of what we can do is that social media, there's about 150 groups to my knowledge which back Corbyn in some way. And some of them have got thousands, tens of thousands of people in them. And those groups, when I put something out on it, I put a little stuff out, it's not normally collected very quickly. You get maybe a few likes on it, maybe a few shares. But when I put your stuff on about immigration, exploding the myth that there was a problem, that immigration was actually, you were actually saying that immigration was a good thing for Britain rather than a bad thing, and it was actually exploding a lot of myths that were around the left. That went wild on that. On 150 groups, it was 750,000 people. I think they got something like 3,000 to 4,000 likes, and something like 200 to 300 shares. Now these are phenomenal numbers into groups. That means it's being viewed by 250,000 people, you know, 200,000 people.
This is a new way of working, and it's interesting because it is, you know, it's very different from being in here. It's great being in here, there's lots of people here, but it's not as effective as somebody at 9:30 at night just flicking through and finding out what's going on. in a way it is like going to a meeting every other night just by going through, but the danger is you're talking to each other. That's you really want to work out ways to get these things tweeted outside of your social circle. We did overnight, went from the 5th to 6th, which is country, we're maybe heading towards the 7th. It's a
we're
study.
The 30th, if you adjust for the pound.
Okay.
How overvalued the pound is, we're actually about 30th.
30th down.
Currency.
Yeah, and as soon as you go for the median person rather than the mean, we're much worse off than the average person is. Just immigration. There's only two parts of Britain that have immigration at levels of Swiss have. Swiss have pretty equitable income. They have very high income of people at the bottom of Switzerland. Only two parts of Britain have immigration rates similar to Switzerland. It's London and Northern Ireland. Those are the two parts that voted most strongly to remain. The fewer immigrants you have, the more likely you were to vote to leave, and the bigger problem you thought the immigrants were. But it was related. The immigrants did tell you there was a problem by not coming. And there was a reason. There's a reason immigrants don't go to Bolsover and don't go to Doncaster in many numbers. And there's a reason why people do come to London. And it needs to be explained. Having people, mainly young, who you have not paid for their education, you haven't paid for their healthcare until they turn up here, who are more innovative than the average person because immigrants have got more get up and go, coming and working in your country, and then possibly returning at the point they might actually need to get something back for their taxes. There's nothing that's quite as economically beneficial as this. And Switzerland, of all places, which is hardly a socialist mecca, but is getting near to voting for higher minimum incomes. Yet Switzerland survives very nicely on much higher rates of immigration than we do. And okay, has issues about it. But it works.
We've got five comrades. If we keep it short and sweet, then we'll try and get everybody in. Comrade over in the yellow at the back.
I like Paul's statistics and stuff like that, but something he said about kind of motivation of the ruling class and the Johnson and Gordon. You said something about they believed in like Darwin struggle. I mean, if that was true and they believed that, then they would have all like walked away in 2008 when the banks collapsed. Yeah, because the Darwinian struggle clearly proved that they were useless. But they didn't. What they did was they got their representatives to turn it round and push it back on the austerity. And I think I thought the point you were missing was that it's in their class interests to do that kind of thing. And it's not some kind of bad people with bad ideas about Darwinism, social Darwinism.
Yeah.
It's the actual. They just make loads of money out of it, and they want to keep doing it.
They do well, and six generations of stockbrokers before David. But how do you live with yourself with those interests? You don't tell yourself I'm going to do this for my class. What you tell yourself is, I am specially able, I am very clever, I've had enormous amounts of money spent on my education, I was born to rule, it is in the good of people like you that I rule you, and of course, and you don't have the ability to know that. And that isn't your fault because you went to normal schools. My impression, not that I mix with that many people like this, given where I am, but my impression of the self-justification of people in that class is that they do think they are superior. And they do think that most other people are inferior, overpaid, even when they're paid very little, and need herding like sheep.
Comrade over there in the black, and we might try and get you two in the red together, possibly, if your questions are short and pithy.
I'm afraid my questions are hopefully short, but I actually have one comment and two questions. And my name's Cedric, I'm actually a member of the Green Party. So my comment is to actually say that so long as Corbyn and McDonald are still around there in a couple of years' time, then the possibility of electoral pacts as the Greens, I think, is quite possible, so that could make a big difference.
Yeah.
The questions are a little bit more technical. One is, so this 9% rise in death rate in one year,
yeah.
It seems like, in a sense, I mean, I don't know, this sounds a bit bad. that's something that really does need publicity now, because it strikes me that having reached that peak, is it going to sustain that? Or are somebody going to be able to say, oh, well, next year there's been a big decrease? So sort of that's statistically significant, is it, I guess. The other question is a bit, I don't know, it doesn't make me unpopular. I'm actually a member of the Equality Trust as well, but I notice from sort of graphs on their site, like headline figures of inequality, they shot up during the 80s on the Thatcher, but they've been more or less stable during the 2010s, as far as I can see, although you might be able to say something about the...
Okay, let me do that. Okay, the first thing on the Greens... in May 2015, the Greens didn't put a candidate up in the city of Chester, and Labour won by less than 100 votes. We have a model of how this can be done. Labour need to give 5 seats to the Greens. The Greens
need, 5 would be great.
5 would be great. And not the 5 in the southwest of England where they can't win, where they come second to the Tories.
Yeah.
But this can be worked out. There will be a slight drop in 2016 because we already have the weekly deaths and we know that they are a little bit less. But we're still tens and tens of thousands above the number we should have if the improvements that have happened in the rest of Europe had continued, the improvements we used to have continued. And I told you my memory was bad. Your last one from the Equality Trust?
Well, really, you said we sort of... An obvious cause of what you're talking about is that it was cut in social care.
Oh, the inequality things.
You put it down to inequality and to decline in social cohesion. And that is social cohesion is
Okay, so since 2010, the gap between the person at the bottom of the top 10% and the top of the other 90% has narrowed. But the 1% have carried on moving away. So everybody has come together, apart from the 1%. So inequality has increased as far as money is concerned and resources. The Sunday Times Rich List doubled their wealth in this period. So you've had a huge inequality between the 1% and inside the 1%, whereas for everybody else, because until recently all the benefit cuts hadn't come through, and the child support was lost by people in the top 10%, and a bit of national insurance came in. So we have had an increasingly equal society since 2010, apart from people in Cameron and Boris's set, people getting over £160,000 a year or more, who've actually seen their income go up more. And part of what I'm arguing is one reason why we've had these massive cuts to these services is because we are not willing to tax the 1%. The 1% currently pay a third of all income tax because they pay themselves so much. If we had normal European levels of income tax and wealth taxes, we could have normal European public spending. And we don't even know that we don't have anywhere near that.
Gentleman on the right and then on the left, and I've got one more over there.
Just a quick comment, I mean, on using social media. I mean, I always think of social media as a means to an end rather than an end in itself. I mean, it is about uncovering all of your statistics that you said about the deaths and so on. But I think it is a means of... we have to have a reality rather than a virtual reality event to actually publicise all of this. And I'm just using as an example, it's a different context. But Unite Trade Union, for example, are now running a campaign of all of the people who've committed suicide shortly after they've been sanctioned and their benefits have been cut, right? And we have a picture of 100 people, photographs of them, the people that have died. And what the campaign is, we go around job centres, we go to the Department of Works and Pensions and say, this is what you're doing, right? And I'm just thinking maybe in that kind of way we need to address what you're talking about, you know, 40,000 people dying, prematurely. Some you need from virtual reality.
You're completely right, and it is so hard to do. You've only got to remember the picture of the little toddler on the beach in Turkey and the effect of that picture. How you connect statistics that tell you that something really bad has happened in general to something that immediately has an effect on you emotionally is very tricky. I'm not that good at it. I've written on it. I've written about a story once of a young man and a young woman. The woman came from an obscure village in what was Poland, and then met her husband, and they settled down in Amsterdam. And then eventually with their children, they got taken back to the obscure village, whose name was Auschwitz. And then she tells this story of a pair of people. It makes you think very differently about a statistic of thousands of numbers. But photograph stories of the person who wasn't found for 4 hours in A&E recently, and the story of the mum who jumped with her baby when she was pregnant, having been sanctioned. These stories are true, and they're what is behind the numbers. And that's, you know, as I said, my real reason for being angry is standing in the ward and working out, you've decided to cut this because you don't care. Yeah. I can't get angry about 87.2 dropping to 86.8. I just know what it means.
Yes, quite often the concept of immigration is a lightning rod for certain aspects of right wing, or, you know, anger and things like that. But there are two aspects of the modern world that are pushing wages down, probably just as much as the perception that immigration is doing. One of them is that we live in a global marketplace where we're competing with people that are paid £10 a day to make pairs of jeans. And, about 80, in 30 years ago, maybe 80% of the clothes from Marks and Spencers were made in this country, but probably now 90% are made abroad.
Yeah.
And the other thing is technology is also driving down, because the owners of the means of production are not us, but the robots.
Yeah.
So that there's a wonderful anecdote that goes something like the trade union rep for the auto union in America has taken around this lovely factory that's just full of robots and no no workers. And so the boss turns around to the trade union rep and he says, how are you going to get these robots to pay their union subs? And the shop steward turns around and he says, well, how are you going to get these robots to drive the cars? Economics and growth.
You're right.
You know,
but
how's it happen?
But the robots in general are good news. I was taken as a small boy, I think by my father, to scare me to the line at Cowley, where there were about more than 30,000 men working in the factory. In the Cowley car factory. I went back a few months ago for the first time. There are 1,100 robots now, and just 3,000 men, almost all men still, working on the last line, looking across at the robots, who will very soon. Half of the men are from Eastern Europe. BMW have made those. Well, the reason there's 1,100 robots is they all fit within a 20-foot container, and you can put them on a lorry and drive them to Germany if you need to move the factory. But
why is that a good thing?
It's a good thing that men are not spending their lives welding stuff underneath a car that's moving constantly. It's a bad thing that a few BMW shareholders, particularly people who own a lot of shares, make a fortune out of this, and most people don't. It's a bad thing that we still want to fill the world with cars when these are the biggest killing machine in our country. But it is a good thing that we have robots, and they'll need somebody to fix them. And even with a robot that can fix robots, somebody will need to fix the robot that can fix robots. But also, we do not all need to work for 40 hours a week.
Yes.
And we are on the edge of being in a position not just to produce our food, but our clothing and our houses that means that generally people who really want to work can work. I've got a friend who, she has a slight obsession. She actually loves cleaning deep fat fryers. Right? No, no, it gives her, she enjoys it. I won't say who she is. And she has the job of going around to restaurants and cleaning their deep fat fryer. That's the world you want. You want the world which mixes the person who actually likes that with the job. And that requires freedom of choice over work, not being forced into a job, but freedom of choice.
Just quickly, obviously, Wood Facility has an idea of what we want for a National Health Service. What do you think are the most critical things that need improvement right now? Obviously, lots more money, specifically handy. Then, what's your ideal vision of an ideal health service?
It's slowly more money. You can't do it that fast. In a national emergency, you'll have to default on the PFI, but they're only getting paid interest because they're taking the risk. So I'm afraid those debts have to be written off. Not out of political choice, just we don't have the money anymore. And then the company's working for a profit. Need to go because you get very bad health, and it's a hard. There's many things in which companies working for profit produces very good things. You get very good socks because the person selling you your socks is trying to make a profit. State socks are bad. And there is a line somewhere in procurement, you know, where it makes sense to use the private sector, and somewhere where it doesn't. And getting that line correct with the health service really matters. And then the last one is getting the private hedge funds out of social care provision. Private hedge funds have moved into care homes and are basing the ownership of the care homes offshore and making huge profit out of the fact that all politicians are too embarrassed to watch old people die in the gutter. So they will fund some form of care home. And we should see social care and care homes as part of the health service. And you cannot have people making billions of pounds out of the fact that, you know, even a fairly nasty upper class are not so nasty that they're willing to watch very elderly people dying on the streets because it's just a huge waste of time. There's lots of things that can be done. Talking about the debt having to be written off, and the same with the student debt. The more you talk about it being written off, the more you make the debt not work. Because what private company is going to fund a loan where there is this implicit threat that it won't be repaid because they'll take the risk? That's what you do as a capitalist, and sometimes the risks fail, particularly when the population votes that they should fail.
I'm mindful that we did start 10 minutes late, so given that you've not asked the question, we'll take a quick question from you. And
my name's Richard Crane. I'm the RMC union rep on London Underground, the cleaners. The question is, do you think we should be blaming David Cameron for the actual his government for the increase in over 75s deaths and the actual lack of NHS care and ambulance care? Because I actually had a parent that died in October, and she was an 86-year-old lady, had to stay laid on the floor where she fell down the stairs backwards for over an hour. Mm. Do you think we should be putting that on social media and asking David Cameron and his cruddy government to actually give a response?
Yeah. A big part of me does think that they are old enough, they've had long enough to learn, to be ignorant of the fact that through your actions you have resulted in these outcomes. I'm into a gentler kind of politics, and I'm that kind of a hippie I was brought up with. Yeah, but there comes a point when I think it is hard to say, I know you were not actually well educated even though it costs this much money. I know your PPE degree with Vernon teaching as your tutor wasn't actually a really good education. I know that at the age of 21 you went to work for Carlton TV and were in a closeted environment and nobody ever told you these things. But to not go out of your way to find out what your critics thought of you, I think is negligent. And that would be my reason to actually put the blame on this particular group. But remember, they only took over in May 2015. They've been waiting all their lives since teenagers for that moment. It was all going to be wonderful, right? They had been waiting to make Britain the great again and the great revolution, and now they're already out. There was only 5 years of a coalition government. It wasn't a year. Before then, there were years and years of New Labour in which the health service was quietly and progressively privatised, in which £1,000 fees came in. So they're partly to blame. And then before then, there is the 18 years of Conservative rule that is certainly to blame. And then before then, there were the people in the southeast of England who voted Tory in 74, but didn't switch the election, but had an effect. And before then, there's Barbara Castle failing to get through places of strife out. And if you go back then and somebody had done something different, then we could be much more like a normal European country. So there's a lot of people you can spread the blame on, many of whom are now dead. But because they're my age, if they were younger, I would let them off out of ignorance. But because they're my age, I think it is fair to say you do hold a responsibility for these deaths. Just as we've said, Tony Blair holds a responsibility for the 150,000 people who died in Iraq. There is a point you cannot say you did not know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.